Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Brighton Rock Podcast. With me and Peter as usual. Hello, Peter.
Hey, Russ.
I'm Russell, of course, yes. And we have a special guest with us for the first part of this episode, episode 175, which is the general manager for the women and girls team at the Albion. It's Polly Bancroft. Hello, Polly. Welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Thanks ever so much for having me. Good to be here.
Excellent. Yeah, really good to have you with us. We bring you on at this particular point. We wanted to get you on anyway, but it's a particularly good time to get you on, I think, because there's a very big game coming up for the women's team, isn't there? The senior women's team on Sunday. And we'll get into the details of that in a moment. But ultimately, it's the semi-final of the FA Cup. Arsenal drawn away, which seems a bit harsh, doesn't it? That's why are there neutral games in the semi-finals? That's not fair. The game's on Sunday. We'll talk about that in more detail later, but it must be a busy time for you at the moment, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it's always a busy time in football, isn't it? But I think it's nice when the games come thick and fast. But yeah, as you said, we've got a big game on Sunday. It's live on the BBC as well, so... we're expecting a big viewing audience as well as a lot of fans attending. And we've actually got some of the Girls Academy and the Women's Under 21 teams coming up to support. So it'd be nice to have a bit of blue in the crowd at Boreham Wood on Sunday.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm hoping to go. I'm still not quite sure if I'll be able to come free in time because I'm working during the day, but I'm hoping to get along. It's actually not that far away from me. I'm in Enfield, North London. So it's kind of a fairly short drive, really, and sort of about 20 minutes or something. So fingers crossed. Yeah, it's Meadow Park, Boreham Wood's home ground for the men's team. Arsenal's, I think it's their normal home ground, isn't it?
As well. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Arsenal women play there all the time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll probably ask you about ticket details and all that sort of stuff a bit later on. But let's get on to sort of talking about your role in general. So we said the general manager for the women's and the girls, encompassing several teams, isn't it? So can you tell us a little bit about your role in general and what it entails day to day?
Yeah, sure. So it's the strategic operations of women and girls football at the club. So I oversee the operations for the women's first team, the women's under 21s, and then the four girls teams within the academy. We have a vision at the club to be a top four WSL club. So we're currently writing a strategy to consider how that can be achieved, both from a technical perspective, from an operational perspective, on the field and off the field for all of those six teams. It's going to take a big joint effort to achieve that because it's a lofty target, particularly with some of the big clubs that we see in the league at the moment and the investment actually that's come since that vision was set. So the vision was set before Manchester United entered the women's game. We've seen Everton invest significantly as well. So when you put those up against Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester City, you know, it is a big target, but it's not one that we're shying away from. So, yeah, on a day-to-day basis, I'm linking in with the marketing team, commercial, communications, operations to embed the female teams within the club and really integrate and see where we can share knowledge and best practice to help achieve that vision of being a top four WSL club. So yeah, lots to do, but we're really enjoying it.
Yeah, you've got a smile on your face.
When you're talking about the club's, you know, the investment, that sort of thing, it makes it, puts it in context what an achievement it was last season to come sixth, doesn't it? It's, I mean, those five clubs, obviously, I think were the ones above us, weren't they? And then we were like top of the rest, which is pretty amazing, really, for Brighton.
Yeah, exactly. To finish top half for the first time in the WSL was a brilliant achievement and certainly one that we're looking to emulate again this season. But you're right, that gap between sixth and the top four was 20 points. Yeah. So it's a big, you know, there is a big step to be taken to get us closer towards achieving that. But, you know, why not dream? Why not, you know, have strong ambitions? So, you know, we're really hoping that the new facility at Lancing at the training ground will play a massive part in helping us to keep the best talent and also to attract high quality players as well throughout the pathway. So we're very, very fortunate, and we're probably up there in terms of one of the best facilities for women's sports, not just women's football, globally. So yeah, it really shows the investment from Tony Bloom and the club into the women's game, and shows how serious they're taking it. But that is a massive card that we've got to play, so we're looking forward to making, you know, every use and opportunity from that building.
That's great. Yeah, very good to hear. Do you find it quite irritating that the big clubs have kind of got, well, the ones that weren't already pre-existing as big sides like Arsenal, that sort of the Man United and Tottenham have kind of jumped on board with this later? It's obviously good in general for the game, but is it quite annoying from an Albion point of view to see them sort of upping their game just as we're seeing the fruits of our labours come into play?
I don't think it's annoying. I think it's absolutely the best thing for the game. And actually, there are other Premier League clubs that aren't yet investing as much, and you'd really encourage, you know, those to do the same. There's still only 12 teams in the league, so competition is quite fierce. And, you know, maybe in the next 5 years, we might see that expand a little bit. But no, it's just really good competition. And, you know, we beat Tottenham a couple of weeks ago. We beat Chelsea last season. So it can be done. We've also taken points from Manchester City in the past as well. So it's certainly doable, even though it's difficult.
Yeah, and that win over Chelsea last season, the 1-0 away win, wasn't it? Wasn't it direct from a corner, if I'm remembering correctly? Was that right? Yeah. It was, right. Yeah, an Olympic goal, apparently, it's called, because it happened in the Olympics once somewhere. I mean, that was a very long unbeaten run that we broke there of Chelsea's, very dominant at the time, well, still are. But that must have been a proud moment, actually, in coming at that time.
Definitely. Yeah, it was, I think it was really needed, and it was the pinnacle of the season as well. They've been on a bit of a difficult run up until that point. And it was the changing point within the season, really. So we went on to have an unprecedented, I think it was 4 wins in a row in the Women's Super League, which we'd not done before. So it was just a great moment. And certainly those images will go up in the new training ground building just to remind us of that moment last season. So, yeah. Not many teams will score against Chelsea, let alone win against them, you know, in their home ground.
It's a sign of the kind of ups and downs of football, isn't it, really? Because wasn't it the week before we lost to Bristol City, I think, who were bottom, and then to go to win at Chelsea, who hadn't lost at home for so long. And it's a beauty of football, really, in a way, isn't it? That, you know, one week you can lose to the team bottom, and the next week you can go somewhere and where they've literally not lost for so long and win 1-0. And
Which makes it even sweeter, right?
Yeah.
And this season started pretty well as well. We've carried on where we left off. I mean, looking at the table, we're fifth at the moment, aren't we? So top half again. There's 12 teams in the division, for anyone that doesn't know. But just sitting in just behind the big guns, basically. So Arsenal, Chelsea, Spurs and Man U being the sides above. But it's tight, obviously. It's early in the season, so we've got teams chasing us as well. But it's looking good to be top half again. In the earlier stages of that, I mean, obviously there was a point we went top right near the beginning, which was fantastic, really, really good. I know you came to Seagulls over London, you were a guest there. And I know at the time you were saying, I think everyone at the club was pretty disappointed with the lack of coverage on that, actually. Obviously BBC as well as Sky are now covering it jointly this season on the BBC's highlights programme, which they have already been doing. It seemed to be the emphasis was on the big clubs and what they were doing. And the fact that this smaller team had got to the top of the table was pretty much kind of passed over completely. I mean, they covered the goal, the goals in the game, and that was pretty much it, wasn't it? I mean, how frustrating must that be? I know you don't want to say too much about it, but I mean, it's got to be pretty frustrating, hasn't it, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, the TV deal as a whole for women's football in the league is fantastic. You know, to get over half of the games on TV is brilliant in terms of raising the profile nationally and wider. So the tide is rising from that perspective. But yeah, of course, when you're sat at the top of the table and you've just won and you're the last on sort of the equivalent of match of the day for women, yeah, it was a little bit disappointing. But I suppose it shows, you know, that we just have to focus on ourselves and, you know, we'll do as much as we can with our own local media networks to try and grow our fan base and our audience locally in Sussex. But yeah, the TV picks, both on Sky and the BBC to date, we haven't had a home match. We had one match away at Chelsea that was live on Sky. We're live on the BBC on Sunday, which is brilliant because the viewing figures clearly for a free-to-air show are much higher than the paid TV. So yeah, be really exciting to see the viewing figures for this weekend. But yeah, of course, you know, every team wants to play on TV at home. So we're hoping that we might get selected at least a couple of times this season.
Yeah, the match of the day curse, obviously, as far as the highlights things go. But yeah, I mean, that's going to be great coverage, definitely, at the weekend. And I suppose in a way, it's not bad to go under the radar in one sense, is it? And it's typical of the media to kind of focus on others. We're used to that as Brighton fans. And, you know, so I suppose that's all fair in love and war. But the main focus will just be obviously on just carrying on, continuing to do as well as you can. In terms of the squad and the personnel, there's been ambition shown in terms of this summer with the signings as well. We've made some really interesting signings for the first team. And that's going pretty well. They've settled in nicely, haven't they?
Yeah, they have done. We've added some, you know, experience in Daniel Carter, some youth in Brunsola Babajide and Franz Stenson. So, and also signed, you know, some of our own in Libby Bance and Maisie Simmons, who was with us last year as well. So, yeah, it's, you know, some real sort of exciting English talent that have, you know, joined us or stayed with us. So, as well as securing Gumin Lee, she was on loan from Man City from last season, the South Korean forward. So yeah, real strength this season compared to last, or certainly built on the squad. It's looking okay.
Yeah, it is looking very good. I do think, yeah, Lee's certainly a really good acquisition. Danielle Carter as well, very skillful, kind of fixed and experienced head as well, in a sense. She looks like she's very calm in front of goal and looks like she can rave about. And Maya Letizia as well is another one who's, I think she's quite flexible from what I can gather. She seems to have been played in different positions from when I have been able to look at games in terms of highlights. I haven't been to a live game yet, I should say. I'm hoping to change that very soon. But in terms of that, she seems quite a flexible figure within the team, and also one of the other high quality players. No relation of Matt Letizia, apparently, I'm told. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. No, she's from Guernsey. She's got Letizia as a surname, but no relation. But yeah, you're absolutely right. Having Danielle's experience, you know, having been a senior England international, she scored at Wembley, you know, she played in FA Cup finals. So to have that knowledge and experience within the squad is a big plus, certainly for our youth internationals. So we had 5 players go away with England youth teams in this most recent international break. So it's great having Dan Carter and for them to learn from and to observe, really. So she's been a great addition.
She's probably the sort of signing we probably wouldn't have been able to make a year before when we were down in like 10th or 11th. But now with, you know, sixth place, you know, we actually are quite attracted to players who maybe have just dropped off the kind of first team of the top four, but want to kind of keep on, you know, first team competing in the top half.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously, you know, knowing that she'd be working with Hope Powell, it's a big plus. Plus the training ground as well. We showed her around the training ground so she could see what was about to open. And then just the investment more broadly across the club, she could see the vision which she bought into, which is great.
Yeah, and of course Hope has been with us for quite a while now. I forgot to check actually how long. It must be about 5 years or so, is it?
Yeah, 4 or 5.
Four or five, yeah. And she's obviously gone from strength to strength again. I mean, obviously her profile is as England manager for quite a long time. And then I didn't really feel I knew what she was doing after that. So, and she's come in and you wondered, oh, is she going to be the person? It's great. It's obviously a high profile name, but she's proved she's got the credentials still, hasn't she? She's really moved the team on. Looks like a cool head as well in terms of, and obviously an experienced head. That must help. Yeah.
Oh yeah, she's so passionate and so driven for the women's game and equality across the game as well. So you'll see her champion and call out where she needs to. So yeah, she's a terrific ambassador for everyone, and you know, obviously so experienced and you know, really, I suppose, passionate about developing individuals as well as the team. So she'll give a lot to both players and staff actually as well. So she's just a fountain of knowledge, really, within the women's game.
It's amazing to think of the equivalent, you know, in a men's game of a team, you know, in what the position that Brighton were in, we were in when she joined, and appointing a former England manager who's got such a good record in the game. I mean, it's huge, isn't it? It was like, must have been a massive boost at the time for the club generally.
Yeah, and again, I think for Hope, just seeing the project, you know, they were in WSL2, which is now the Championship, so the second tier to start off with, to then get promoted, and also again sort of see that vision, and you know, she had a big input in terms of the new building and was, you know, the champion to get a swimming pool in there. So yeah, she certainly had her mark and will leave a terrific legacy whenever she decides to do something else. But yeah, it's great having her at the club, and yeah, just her experience alone is a massive help.
I think that's a Tony Bloom trait generally, isn't it? I think in the men's game as well, he brings the managers to be a project rather than just to kind of come in and manage. It's kind of you have to engage and, you know, kind of be a part of the club and engage in that sort of side of things as well, rather than just come in and do a job and then head off again almost. It's kind of...
Yeah, exactly. We joke that our jobs or our work isn't done until we've won the Champions League back-to-back.
So, why stop it back to back?
Well, I was saying, like, you can't just win it once, you have to retain it.
There's a Bond film out at the moment. We've got to be thinking about world domination here, Polly, surely.
Why not?
Yeah. I was going to say, so your working relationship with Hope is, I don't know how much contact you have day to day with her, but how does it work in general? Because I guess it's probably mixed, isn't it, depending on what's going on week to week?
Yeah, so we're in, each day that the women's first team are training, I'm there as well. So Hope and my office are next door to each other. We're on WhatsApp probably on a daily basis. So yeah, really close working relationship. I actually knew Hope when I worked at the FA. So we've known each other a long time. So that was quite nice coming into the environment with a familiar face and a good relationship already. So no, we get on really well. It's just really nice to work with her. And I just see my role to try and provide her and the technical staff and the players with everything they need to be able to perform on a daily basis. So, we're both driven. We both have, those ambitions to succeed and do as well as we can. So, it's a good relationship.
How does it work in terms of the structure? Obviously, we've got Dan Ashcroft, who's a major figure sort of overseeing various aspects of the footballing side. Where does your position sit in regard to him? Do you have, is he directly under you, above you, or is it kind of side on a bit more? How does it work?
Yeah, so the women's department's split into two different areas. So there's the technical side, and Hope reports into Dan Ashworth, technical director. And then on the operations side, I report into Paul Mullen, the chief operating officer. Right. And that allows us to have the knowledge and experience of both those sides. We kind of meet in the middle, and we're really aligned on areas that overlap. But we have the technical experience of Dan, which is fantastic, as well as the operational support from Paul.
Yeah, that's good. On another matter, actually, just you mentioned about Tony Bloom's vision and everything else, and succession planning is clearly a very big part of that for him across the board. In terms of the women's game, so on the playing side in particular, we're looking at here really, what's going on there in terms of, because you've got Amy Merricks is number two, isn't she? And I've heard her interviewed on a couple of podcasts before, and she came across very well. She seems a very intelligent, astute kind of person, figure within the club. Is she planning to kind of step on to become a coach herself, or is she looking at a different role? And who else, is there anybody else already in the mix for longer term planning?
Good question.
Sorry, I put you on the spot there. Yeah, I think obviously you want to keep hoping anyway, yeah, for the long term.
But... I think, you know, Amy's just learning on a probably weekly basis from Hope still. So, you know, there is so much knowledge and experience, you know, in that head of hers that I'm sure Amy is, you know, really benefiting from that. She's also taking, or I think she's applying to take her pro license as well. So she's done her A license recently. So, you know, there's still, you know, plenty of opportunities for her to grow and develop within her current role. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure of her own personal ambitions right now.
Yeah, you were saying you'd work with Hope at the FA. Is that your background before then? Were you at the FA beforehand? And
so I was at UEFA and I relocated from Switzerland to Sussex. So I was there for 5 years working in women's football development and supporting their 55 federations across Europe. Wow. And then before that, I was at the FA doing women's football development. So the time I met Hope, the team was much smaller. I was working on sort of commercial activations. I was doing player appearances with the Lionesses, doing participation programs, working with education partners. So I think they've now got about 10 staff in to do what I was doing when I was there. But just shows the growth really in the game over that period of time. And yeah, Hope was the national team manager when I was there. So we'd align on various events and trying to raise the profile and that kind of thing.
So Brighton's your first kind of like club rather than country or your, you know, kind of bigger kind of network then at the moment?
Yeah, I was on the board at Nottingham Forest, where I'm from originally. So I was on their women's board for just over 2 years. So I had an insight really into club development, but also working at UEFA, we'd support women's leagues and then consult with clubs on that side as well.
Sure. It must be quite a different role then, being day-to-day at a club as compared to doing maybe kind of, yeah, working for the UEFA or the FA. Be quite a kind of interesting change.
Yeah, that's right. I was actually at the Euro draw in Manchester last night. So the draw for which teams are going to play in which groups at which stadium. And yeah, I was speaking to a lot of former UEFA and FA colleagues at that event and saying exactly that. Actually, the transition from a federation to a confederation, then to a club, was actually bigger than I expected. And whilst I've worked in women's football development for almost 15 years, I think getting my feet on the ground and having direct impact on operations and delivery, I'm absolutely loving it. But yeah, it probably took a longer time for me to make that transition than I expected.
Yeah, it certainly looks like you really enjoy it. As I mentioned before, you came on the Seagulls Over London meeting in town. And you could tell by the way you were talking about it and smiling away with it. You know, you're obviously clearly loving the role there. And it seems that it's a happy place to work in general, the Albion. I keep hearing good stories about good work environment, just a nice vibe. And it's good to see that you're really enjoying it down here.
So, yeah, the staff are just so... The wider club staff are so supportive. They're really keen to learn more about women's football, to understand what it's like to be a female player. I mean, obviously the club have been going since 1901, but to adopt a professional women's team in the last three seasons, you know, is quite a culture shift, you know, to understand, you know, the differences between male and female players. So that's, I suppose, what I'm enjoying most, is seeing that almost weekly progression. You know, whether it's tailoring the kit to young female players, learning about the menstrual cycle and the impact that that has on performance. So some of those nuances within the women's game and just that keenness for the club to learn and to adopt. And it's just, yeah, an open door and sort of welcoming environment for the club to learn more around women's football. So, yeah, it's a brilliant environment. And I'm just really lucky to work with so many talented people. We've got about 25 staff in the women's department in total, from, you know, the girls' academy up to the women's first team. And yeah, everybody's so dedicated and committed that it's a wonderful environment to be in, and I'm very fortunate to be there.
Brilliant. Is there much interaction between the men and women's first team and the lower and the younger levels as well? That sort of thing.
It's been a bit difficult recently because of the protocols and trying to keep teams into separate testing pools. So we've actually been discouraging crossover. So we have different meal times, different training times, we're on different pitches just to try and protect the players as much as possible. We've been doing Zoom calls or outdoor meetings. So there is certainly there's that crossover between staff, if not players yet, but as and when the time is right, then that will certainly be encouraged to try and get more integration and crossover between the players.
That's all good. Yeah, I think those little details, as you said, about getting the kits and looking at particular requirements tailored towards the women's game, I think it's really important, isn't it? I think I don't know how to what degree other clubs are doing that, but if we're doing every single bit that we can be doing, that's got to help put us in an advantageous position, both for the welfare of the players, but also for maybe being that bit more of an appealing club to come to for other players as they hear about it.
Yeah, exactly. So we've changed the colour of the shorts. So, you know, for young girls starting their menstrual cycle, wearing a white pair of shorts isn't ideal for confidence levels. So we've now changed that to a darker pair, and we'll continue to do that moving forwards. And we've had support from Nike and our commercial team in doing that. So again, it's that understanding, oh gosh, of course, you know, let's change. Mm. So that's been really welcomed. Also the kit sizes, you know, as girls' bodies are changing, they might prefer, you know, a larger fit or a men's fit at some stage of their development. Others might want a women's fit. So it's just trying to work out how girls feel most comfortable and giving that option and that voice really to say what is best for them. And I think one of the really good projects that we've created is a player council, where we're giving players the voice, you know, to let us know some feedback on things like kit. You know, things that might not seem that important, but actually are really important, you know, to some of our players. And that player council is also being adopted on the male pathway as well. So, I mean, clearly you can't give players, you know, the decisions on everything, but it's good to consult with them on areas where, you know, they can have a voice.
Brilliant. Yeah, sounds a really good idea.
You mentioned the girls team there as well. Obviously, you're covering the younger groups as well. How are things progressing there in terms of both on and off pitch? Is it all going to plan? Are there lots of things you still feel you need to do with those teams at those levels?
I went to go watch the under 12s a couple of weeks ago, and they were absolutely brilliant. So they play in a boys' league, and they're just technically fantastic. And I think, you know, the job that they're doing to raise the profile of women's football, you know, within their league, and you know, for the boys that they play against and the parents of the boys that they play against to sort of change perception perhaps of girls' football. They were absolutely brilliant, you know, quick on the attack, they kept the ball well, they were moving really well. They were an absolute joy to watch. So, you know, I'd encourage anyone as and when we can to go and watch some of the youth teams. Because yeah, they're just super impressive, you know, and excellent footballers who just happen to be girls. I suppose the main difference between the boys and the girls pathway at the moment is that some of the boys get a day release from school and education, whereas we don't have that yet on the girls' side. So the girls are training in the evenings at weekends, whereas the boys sometimes train during the day, which means then they've got time to do their homework and eat properly before going to bed, whereas the girls are having to do football and then homework and then eat and then go to bed. So it takes a bit more out of the girls, I'd say. So they get a bit more tired, and they're perhaps not able to put in the quality in terms of the freshness that the boys get on their side. So there's still plenty that we can do, but I can't imagine that would come in anytime soon. I think particularly because there's only sort of 12 teams that are professional, maybe a couple in the Championship as well. So 14 professional teams in England. There's only one other professional league in the world, and that's in the US. There are professional teams across Europe, in Germany and in France and Scandinavia, but the market is just not there. It's not mature enough to have professional contracts at younger ages at the moment. So, I suppose it's those kind of growing pains between trying to professionalise the women's game, yet also realise the resource that we've got, and try and find a balance really between the two.
It's amazing that summer, wasn't there record transfer was like 250,000 or something like that. And you look at the men's game where Neymar's obviously gone for 200 million a few years ago, and it's the difference is, you know, crazy. And Danielle Carter was our first money player we bought for money, wasn't she?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, yeah, even in our side, you know, we paid 20 million or roughly 20 million, I think, for a player on a men's side. So, I mean, it's,
yeah. We're starting to see that in the recruitment. So in the market, there are we're starting to see, you know, huge requests and demands for salaries, yet there is no, you know, there just isn't that level of income. Yes, we've got a TV deal for the first time where clubs receive money and revenues from the TV, but it's absolutely not at the same percentage as the men's game. So, which again, it's that fine balance of trying to professionalise on the pitch but be sustainable at the same time.
And so the bigger clubs are in a way the ones who, where the owner wants, will just subsidise it basically, and kind of, and not want to kind of be sustainable, just kind of pay the money, which is the same in the men's game actually as well,
exactly.
In a way.
Exactly. Yeah,
pretty much. The with the women's game, obviously, it sounds like the new generations are developing more, maybe stepping the game on more, which is great to see. And obviously, we look forward to the fruits of that coming later on down the line. But I do think there's giant steps that had to have been made, haven't there, through the years, because of the way it was historically. I actually don't have the timeline to recollection at the moment, but I know there was a substantial period of time where the women's game was banned, essentially. Women were banned from playing, which seems both ludicrous and sort of pretty disgusting by anyone's standing, for a sizable amount of time while it was still being played in other countries. And we've set ourselves back hugely with that, haven't we? I guess, is it still a recovery period? We're still seeing the effects of that, the recovery period still ongoing?
Absolutely. Must be. Yeah, we're still trying to recover from that ban. Girls still don't necessarily see football as a sport for them, so they're not necessarily participating at school. If you're not participating at school, you're unlikely to play in a club. So it still has this long-lasting effect that we're trying to change culture. You know, this perception that football is a boys' sport. You know, we're still trying to get over, both the girls themselves, parents, you know, society. So yeah, it was devastating, and yeah, there's still an awful lot to do to get back to where the game was.
It's almost a flip side of America, isn't it? In America, it's perceived as a girls' sport, and only in more recent times it's become popular, in fact, hugely popular in the men's game. There are some really big crowds now. In terms of the women's game, speaking about crowds, I'll ask you first about with schools. Have you got any idea in terms of school curriculums, what proportion of schools will have football for girls as a pretty much as a default option? Is it still kind of hit and miss in terms of which schools have that as part of their normal PE and other recreational activities?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't have those stats.
No, that's right.
The county FA certainly would, but I might be wrong in saying this, but I wonder if it's down to the individual school to determine which sports they select, and of course then which facilities they've got and which qualifications the teachers have got and that kind of thing. So I don't know, but my guess would be that it's dependent on the teachers at the school to choose.
Yeah. Well, getting on to crowds then. So, I mean, first of all, there's a couple of questions around Albion's home game. So, and the general setup is you get occasional home games at the Amex, which is part of an arrangement. But you can't do that too much, obviously, because of the wear and tear on the pitch and various other things. Home games are generally played at Crawley's men's home ground, which is the Albion women's home ground, on an ongoing basis at the moment. I know a lot of people would like bigger crowds to be there, and I guess there is a possible issue with the geography of the situation in terms of whether Albion fans would travel that far if they are indeed not that close to Crawley. Are there plans in place longer term to get back into a more of the Brighton and Hove area, or at least closer to it? And how are the crowds in general at the moment anyway?
So pre-COVID, we had an average of 1,300 at the women's games, and we're just surpassing that at the moment. So we've seen some brilliant crowds so far this season, including 2,500 at the Amex for the opening game. I think we have to be mindful as well, sort of post-pandemic, you know, people's confidence levels of returning to mass events and sporting events. So I think there's generally across the league, attendances have been down for those reasons, and you know, understandably so. Plus then, you know, the testing protocols and things that make it slightly more difficult than it used to be to buy a ticket and get a test to demonstrate those sort of administration processes. But having said that, yeah, we've been really pleased with the crowds that we've had at Crawley. We've got another game at the Amex on Sunday the 14th of November, and that's against Leicester City. So we're hoping to build on that opening day attendance. So, yeah, we're hoping to get maybe closer to 4,000 or 5,000 for that game. We're actually working in conjunction with the local Girls and Women's League. So they're looking at changing their fixtures to enable female players that play locally to come and watch. As at the moment, a lot of women's football takes part on a Sunday, and senior women's football is at 2 o'clock. So you've got a direct clash there with people that play to try and get them to come and watch. So that the Girls League have been absolutely brilliant in being flexible and supporting the Brighton and Hove Albion women's first team. Yeah. We're also doing other things by engaging with the Royal Pavilion Museums Trust. So they're doing a special offer for some of their members. We're engaging with schools through Albion in the community, Wildcat centres through the County FA. So we're really trying to engage with as many community partners as possible, yourselves included, and hopefully some other supporters' trusts within the men's section of the club. So, yeah, we're really trying as much as we can to boost attendances. You know, it's a really welcoming atmosphere at Crawley and at the Amex, and we're actually quite lucky to have those two really good options to play at. We've just done a profit and loss exercise to determine how many tickets we need to sell at the Amex to make it cost neutral or to break even. So that's been a really interesting part. We need to do the same for Crawley. And I suppose this sort of research going on in the background to determine where the women's team is best placed. Mm. You know, are there other locations in Brighton, in terms of attracting supporters, but also from an operation and a performance perspective. So we're speaking to other clubs as well. So Birmingham City, Reading, Watford, Leicester, who play at the men's or the main club stadia, to see what their experiences are like. So, yeah, we're doing a bit of a feasibility study and some research into where the best place is for the women's team to be in the future. But equally, Crawley have been great hosts and really looked after us. And the quality of the surface there has really improved as well. So, we've got nice options, which is good.
That's good. Good to hear. I'm assuming traditionally the crowds have tended to be families in general, and particularly sort of women and girls going a lot to the games, and not so much sort of male, say adult males, for example. And is that the biggest kind of thing to try and get more? Obviously, you want to get people across the board in greater numbers, but in particular men. For example, I don't think, Peter, you've not been to a women's game yet, have you? Same as me. In my case, and probably yours as well, being in London, it's more logistical than anything. Yeah. But in general, it's getting people like us to go along and give it a try, isn't it, I would imagine?
Yeah, it is actually still majority male. We're really trying to target people that play football, because if you play football, you're likely to go and watch or bring your kids along as well. So that's one of our focus, is as well as those community groups, is to have a think about, you know, five-a-side centres, men's clubs, because if you play football, you have an interest in it, and there's always football on, right? So that's some of our target sort of strategic target audiences. But you know, obviously everyone is welcome. Young, old, male, female, ethnic minority, anybody is welcome, and we'd hope that they have a good experience while they're with us.
It must be harder as well with Albion's games being moved around so much this season. You know, kind of, we very rarely seem to be Saturday 3 o'clock kickoff this season. So, you know, if you go to Sunday, but then it clashes with an Albion playing away or something like that, or even it must be hard at the weekend when Brighton are playing Saturday at home, but then people are like, well, I've been to football on Saturday, can I commit to going 2 days in a row or something? It's kind of, because the loyal supporters almost are lost a bit, because they're kind of the ones who go Saturday, so even away from home. And so that means that they've got probably less, more other things to do on Sunday than football, basically, because they've basically done football Saturday.
And exactly, and there's a couple of direct clashes at the moment. So, for example, the women's team play away at Everton, 6th of November, exactly the same day, exactly the same time as the men play Newcastle at home. So from a comms perspective, that's quite difficult to inform your supporters of what's happening at two matches that kick off on the same time. It's not ideal when the men's game gets shifted to the same day and time as the women's, but equally the women's could be changed for TV as well. So you've now got two moving parts that are almost out of your control. operationally, it can be quite tricky.
That's difficult, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
And obviously Newcastle, everyone will be keen to go along to show their support for the new ownership regime there, I'm sure, for that match. Maybe not, maybe not.
They're welcome to Everton away instead.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So in terms of the next game coming up, this FA Cup match, it's at the weekend, it's on Sunday, it's 4:45 kickoff, isn't it, I think I'm right saying. So it's Arsenal against the Albion, the other semi-finalist, Chelsea against City, I think, isn't it, by the way. I think I've heard mixed reports that it's the first time, or alternatively the first time since 1976 that we've been in the semi-final. I think the latter is correct, isn't it? We have been there before, but not for a long, long time. I'm not even sure, actually. Somebody quite probably shaking their head. Doesn't matter. That's all history stuff anyway. But it's a very rare treat for us to get there. If anybody can get along, please do so. I mean, you can find the details on the club website, which I've just had a look at, which is... reserve seating in their main east stand, adults £12 and the half price for concessions. There's also unreserved seating in the west stand or standing areas, which is £8 for adults, half price for concessions. So obviously you can get your tickets through the website. I'm guessing at this stage, possibly maybe collecting them on the day if you do that, might be an option. Can people go and turn up and get in on the door? I'm presuming they can. Can they, Polly? Do you know about that?
They're certainly being encouraged to buy in advance. I think ticket sales are going quite well at the moment, so I wouldn't want anybody to miss out. So I would certainly advise booking online. It's likely an e-ticket anyway, so you probably need to have that on your phone to show anyway rather than a print at home. So I would certainly encourage people to do that in advance.
Okay, that's great. And please do go along if you can, guys and girls. It should be a good event. And who knows, Arsenal have had a pretty good start themselves this season. It's looking daunting, but it's probably the worst draw on paper.
Both men and women's team this weekend have got a pretty daunting game.
Yeah, yes, exactly. The Albion playing Liverpool, for which we'll be doing a preview on this episode in a later part. But as far as it goes, Paulie, just to quickly finish off. So you mentioned Nottingham Forest earlier. You're working with them. You're from that area. You're a Forest fan, aren't you? I was hoping to keep congratulating you on the amazing start you've had under Steve Cooper. A load of 3-goal scoring wins. Unfortunately, it went a little bit wrong at the weekend with a certain Fulham team that's on fire. But generally, they've done all right, haven't they? So best of luck to them. You said at Seagulls over London, you're also a bit of an Albion fan now, having kind of been around for a while now with us. Is that true?
My son's got two kids. So, I think that shows where my loyalties are.
Perfect. Brilliant. That's good to hear. Excellent. And that's a good note to end on, Polly, I think. So thank you very much for joining us. And we look forward to...
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me. And we'd love to do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Yeah, you'd be very welcome to come back on. Absolutely. Great.
Maybe we'll call you in the final next time.
Do a special for the final, yeah.
Or the Amex on the 14th. You're very welcome there as well.
Yes, that's it. That's against Leicester, isn't it, that one? Yes. For anyone looking for tickets for that one too. Great. Thanks then to Polly Bancroft for joining us. Fantastic. So that was great to hear there from Polly Bancroft, the women and girls general manager at the Albion. That was a really good interview, isn't it, Peter? Really enjoyed hearing from her. Yeah, she's great. And really, really do wish them the best of luck for the coming weekend and that big FA Cup match. Anyway, part two, we've got John Gibbons, actually. He couldn't make it. It's Neil Atkinson. Our old friend Neil Atkinson's joining us in part three for a preview of Liverpool. Before we do that, we won't spend too much on this, really, time-wise, but the Leicester game in midweek, a disappointing result in the end. League Cup fourth round. It was a 2-2 draw in normal time. And then we lost on penalties, which is not something we do that often, actually, in shootouts. But Leicester, I did feel we're going to win it when it went to penalties. I had no confidence at all because they've got a lot of good takers. And we have a bit of a sketchy record with our current crop, apart from Grosch and McAllister, who did put theirs away. Anyway, the team lineup for this one was stealing goal. So he got back in his usual role for this competition. Webster made his first start back. Duffy and Roberts, young Roberts, the other two. Playing with Veltman wider to the right and Byrne in the left wing-back role, his favourite. Grosch and McAllister as the midfielders. And then we had a mixture, an interesting lineup up front of, two of Albion's favourite strikers, Lacardia and Connolly, and also young Sarmiento, who is a real talent, a box full of tricks, skillful, fast, dynamic. He was a plus point in what was seen to be a 3-4-3. 3 formation effectively. There weren't many others. Certainly, from what I've heard from people that were at the game, neither of us were. But from people that were, Connolly and Licardia, neither of whom made any great impression at all. Sarmiento did. And I think Duffy did well. McAllister, I think, did well. And a couple of the subs as well. Roberts also did well at the back. What was your... I mean, you didn't see the game, neither did I, Peter, in terms of just the goals, isn't it, so far?
The frustration, from what I heard, isn't so much that we lost, because I think we felt we probably would, but that we put quite a decent side out, and if it wasn't for a couple of errors, we could easily have won. I think it was we gave the goals away that we conceded, whereas, like, we... Well, certainly for the second one, we worked a well-worked goal, but for the first... Their two goals, we gave them the goals, basically, and that's... The frustration, in a way, that we gifted two goals to them and still managed to get a draw. You know, if we'd not done that, hopefully we'd have got a win. So the frustration isn't so much that we drew and then lost on penalties, because, you know, 2-2, like I felt at Leicester when we lost 1-1 in the FA Cup last year, it was a decent result, you know, overall against, you know, considering the team we put out. It was just more that we could have done better if it hadn't been for a couple of individual errors. I mean, yeah, I think the front three shows where our weakness is, doesn't it, really? I mean, without Welbeck fitness, and Mope did come on, obviously, in the end. But yeah, it shows where the weakness in the side is, because the rest of that team looks okay generally. It's not big problems. Obviously, Burns now out, which is another blow, seemingly for a bit of time, which is a frustration, because I think it was a comment was made elsewhere that we just finally got all our defenders fit, and then we lose another one because.
If you are losing another one, at least we have got them fit first, I suppose.
Yeah,
but conceding an early goal again, and from a mistake again, same with the City game of the weekend. It's Harvey Barnes that got the goal at the beginning after 6 minutes from a Luke Steele mistake. Not Ashley Barnes, yes, as some people in the pre-match publicity were saying. And it wasn't 3 points for grabs, Harvey. But he did get the goal 6 minutes from that mistake by Steele. We eventually equalised in 3 minutes into stoppage time in the first half with Webster making that comeback game. He actually got on the score sheet with a kicked finish as well. Wasn't a header. Pretty decent, I think, you know, and bounced back well. Only problem is they then scored within a couple more minutes, even later into injury time in the first half, through Lookman from a mistake by Sarmiento, who had a very good game apart from that. He found himself back to goal fairly deep on, trying to kind of shuffle past somebody and then tried to lay it off, I think, presumably for the goalkeeper to pass out wide to the other side, but didn't quite get the measure of things. And in ghosted Lookman and scored. We did get a goal later in the game through Mwepu, which is great to see. He got a good assist against Cardiff, and that was a really well-taken goal. His first goal for us, isn't it? I think I'm right in saying. Yeah. 71st minute.
He's got an assist in one of the previous League Cup games for no goals.
Yeah. And I mean, I suppose it's testament to us that despite those mistakes, Leicester were very happy to get to penalties in the end, from what I've heard. Yeah. And in the end, as I said, I didn't feel confident with the shootout. I thought they'd beat us. Morpay hit the bar with his penalty, same end where he missed the penalty last season. And then Mwepo himself missed the other one. He didn't look very confident stepping up, actually. So maybe that's something, maybe that was just on the day, or maybe that's generally not his forte, I don't know. But yeah, it wasn't a particularly well-taken one. It was saved, and that was the decider. So it's 4-2 on pens to them. They go through to the quarters. We miss out again on the quarterfinals. We never seem to get there. Overall, I was reasonably happy that we managed to make a good fist of it, at least. Scoreline overall, isn't it? A kind of respectability. And not much more to say, just in terms of stats. Interestingly, we have 57% possession, and we had more shots off target and the same number on target, which was 5, by the way. And I think we had more corners. So there's a lot of attacking intent in there, by the looks of it. And those that went to the game, I won't look through the Seagulls over London WhatsApp, but there was a few people from SOL who went to the game and all met up, which is great to see. I think the general feedback was that Licardia was very lethargic and couldn't be bothered, or didn't look like he could. Connolly had missed one good chance and then didn't do much else. I think he snapped at a ball he could have run onto more.
Sarmiento sounds like he might be, if you're playing a front three or like that, then might be actually ahead of one. Certainly Licardia, you'd have thought at the moment. I mean, he sounds like he had a really promising couple of games. He came in against Swansea as well and looked promising. He's done well in the under-23s. Yeah. And we know Graham Potter's not afraid to put young players in. Given our lack of options up front, he actually may get a chance to get in the team and certainly cement a place on the bench, if not in the team, even if he gets, you know, he gets his go.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about you. I probably, this was already the case, but I'm all the more so. I'm now done with Licardia. You know, he's got his one moment to try and prove himself. I didn't like the way he's warming up at Norwich. You know, there's something about him which just doesn't look like he's giving enough of a good impression.
No, I don't think he's that committed. I don't think in some
he's
way.
He's not committed enough. We need commitment. So we're not going to have that. We can have someone of equal quality who's more committed. That may not be good enough quality, you could argue, but at least you'd have someone more committed. Yeah. And that's at the very least what you expect from any player. So I'm done with him, really. And I would like us to
replace... It feels like he was a bit of not a panic buy, but certainly we've been linked with quite a few strikers in the summer, the first season up, and then obviously needed to get one in the winter because we were struggling to score goals. And yeah. We didn't... I mean, you could argue the biggest thing he did, first of all, in the first season was to turn Murray's form around, and Murray got through his best scoring streak just after the Cardia signed.
Yeah. In terms of the other games, the other interesting one was Man City lost to West Ham. Another away side losing in the same sequential order in terms of the way the penalties panned out. Interestingly, West Ham took theirs first and the misses were at the exact same point. So they won theirs 4-2. So that's a bit disappointing that City are out. If we had got through on pens, which is a lottery, isn't it? We would have avoided City, the perennial winners at this tournament.
Yeah, there's still plenty of quality in there, and I don't think we'd have won the league
up. Liverpool are still there, Chelsea are still there.
You know, because...
We could have played Sunderland.
You get a draw of QPR or Sunderland, Jair or someone like that at home, or even someone like West Ham at home. You know, it would have been more of an even game, and then
if we'd got Brentford, we could have had another nice day out in West London by the river again, couldn't we?
That's
very annoying. In fact, you missed it last time, didn't you?
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so all the more I'm disappointed for you, Peter, because it might have been that. Any home game would have been interesting, and I would have started to get to the games really from the quarterfinal stage, but. I just have to.
Glory hunters just rock up.
Glory hunters. I have to cut my cloth somewhere, and I had to draw the line with the League Cup early rounds. But yeah, so we have to wait till next year for that one. I mean, the FA Cup, I'm really hopeful that we can go on a long run there. You know, this team is capable of winning a major trophy with a lot of fortune and with some good play and maybe a bit of luck with the draws themselves.
Yeah,
Yeah. Why not? We might be able to. We're capable.
We lost the semi-finals with a less good squad and a fortunate run. I think the key will be either getting Welbeck back or getting a striker in January, because inevitably we play a slightly weaker team in the FA Cup. I wonder if we'll start, you know, kind of we need to get someone else in for that. But yeah, I mean, there's no reason why we couldn't have a decent run in the FA Cup this season. Obviously, if you draw City away in the third round, you're probably going to lose. But if you have a reasonable run and have a few games then who knows?
No. Yeah. Well, it's on to Liverpool next. And after this next break, we're going to be talking to the Anfield Raps, Neil Atkinson, about, that game that they've just had at the weekend. I'm sure he'll be reveling and talking about that. And also his thoughts on the game coming up this weekend between our sides. So stay tuned for that in part 3, coming up after this short break. Okay, so Peter and I are now joined by the Anfield Raps. He's basically the royalty of the Anfield Raps, as far as I'm concerned. John Gibbons will be really upset if I say that. It's Mr. Neil Atkinson. How are you doing, Neil?
I'm very good indeed, very good indeed. It's a pleasure to be on as ever, Russ.
Excellent, great. Really good to have you on. We've been chatting off air, waxing lyrical about a certain game at the weekend that you guys were enjoying rather too much, I think. or is that possible, in fact, with a win over those guys? Yeah, but
absolutely not possible at all.
Ever feel realistically enjoy it too much if we won 5-0 at Palace, would we? Let's be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we might get into that a little bit in a moment. But first of all, you know, in terms of your season, great start, isn't it? Back on track after a comedy of injuries last season, which you kind of almost got a laugh, haven't you, how bad it got in the end. But you've got those players back and I know there's still a couple of injuries still troubling you, but you're back on track, aren't you now?
I think we very much are. I think in the end you were able to sort of call it a comedy of injuries, because in a lot of ways, a lot of the worst things that could happen to a football team happened, and Liverpool still managed to secure third place by the end of the season. I think it would have been a really tough blow for the club if they'd have lost Champions League status for a number of reasons. The money is one of them, but also I think just in general, Liverpool's players want to have a go at winning the Champions League every single season. It's where they view themselves. It's what they see themselves as. And in the end, Liverpool just about earned that spot, even under the circumstances of all of the injuries. And it really was. It wasn't just Van Dijk. You know, I think at the times that's been overblown. It was Van Dijk, and then 6 games later, having when he played brilliantly, it was Joe Gomez. And then in amongst all of that, Joel Matip hung on in until around Christmas, but he was playing with an injury, which he then aggravated around Christmas, got another game or two in January, and then he was out for the rest of the season as well. Within that as well, Fabinho moves into centre-back. He gets injured playing there. Jordan Henderson started centre-back in the Merseyside derby. He got injured playing there. You know, it was spectacular stuff. And in the end, now you can sort of laugh at it. And also you can go, that's about as bad as it can possibly be. And Liverpool still came third. And there's loads of reasons for that. Last time we were on, we talked about financing football and all of that sort of stuff. Ultimately, what helped Liverpool in the end was Liverpool's budget is just so big, you know, that they've got a massive wage budget there for Liverpool. They've got all this talent right the way through the squad. So they were able to cover the deficiencies that were present at centre-half, even whilst playing people like Phillips and Williams, who weren't obviously quite as good as the players that they've replaced. But Liverpool remodeled the side, finished the season really strongly, and haven't really looked back, to be honest with you. Liverpool were awful in February and early March, and then they don't play for much of the rest of March. But since sort of the start of April, even with the centre-half still being out, Liverpool are unbeaten since then in the league. And I think it's sort of, they've found a real vibe against adversity. And then that's shifted into a new campaign, having secured Champions League football for the season, shifted into a new campaign. A few players have had a really good break over the summer, and they've just hit the ground running so far this season.
I suppose, obviously, with hindsight, it's a great thing, but as City did with failing to replace Kompany, do you think failing to, either letting Lovren go or failing to replace him is a big mistake, I suppose, in that sense?
I think so, but I think Liverpool's transfer policy, Liverpool have become the sort of, have got themselves back to the sort of global status of a club. You know, one of the things they do, he waits for Van Dijk, Klopp. So they don't sign Van Dijk in the summer because they upset Southampton with the way they go about it. Perfectly reasonably, by the way, hasten to add, you know, they went about it the wrong way. So they took the medicine and didn't sign anyone for 4 months. And Klopp was prepared to wait. And then at that time, there was a lot of criticism of Klopp for doing that. I think in this one, I think they really wanted Konate. I think they ended up signing. And I think they felt they had to wait 12 months and they weren't prepared to compromise then. Because I think Liverpool feel as though Liverpool do spend big money and, as I say before, have a really big wage budget. But I think part of how they do that is they try not to get anything wrong. So if they've identified this is the one we want, they are prepared for whatever reason to wait. So in the long run, Konate just started at Old Trafford. Whenever he's played this season, he's looked really, really impressive. He looked impressive in pre-season. You know, he looks like he could be a serious footballer for Liverpool. So in the long run, it may well be that they didn't get it wrong. But in the short term, I would venture that, yeah, they did. That one of the things that hurt them last season is getting that decision wrong. They take a gamble, and I think they'd have felt it was a pretty low-stakes gamble, and it ended up being an exceptionally high-loss gamble over the course of the season. So, I think it's one of the ones that I can't wait to read people's memoirs about, if you know what I mean. I want to read the autobiographies on this one. What did Klopp think? What did Edwards think, who's the de facto sporting director? What did Mike Gordon, what do they all really think now? They'll never tell you honestly right now, but maybe 10 years after retirement, they'll let us know what they really thought of it and how they thought it got on and what they thought about it in the long term.
Because I would say, well, Van Dijk obviously was a massive freak, and it was, you know, that was, you know, there was no real suggestion ever that that would happen. Gomez and Matip both had, I would say, quite questionable injury records. So to go in with two of them as two of your three centre-halves was a risk. It was kind of...
I think it was, but I think they'd had a look at Fabinho back there and quite liked it. And I think they thought, like, we go to Chelsea and win 2-0 at the start of that season with Van Dijk and Fabinho as the centre of our partnership, and Fabinho looks great. But ultimately, there was a point where for Fabinho, I think it just wrecked his head when he was getting picked almost as the senior centre-back at one point, not just someone filling in, but as Liverpool's go-to centre-back option. I think it almost undid his ability to play the position. I actually think over the course of the season, Fabinho gets worse at centre-back. And then when he gets himself back in defensive midfield, he's so determined to prove, listen, I can protect this back four from here. If you put me in it, I'm more vulnerable. And he ends the season, last 10 games or so, Fabinho back in holding midfield, playing brilliantly, absolutely brilliantly across those 10 games. And I think it was firstly being conscious of what was behind him because it was the two younger, less experienced, less good players in Phillips and Williams, but also with a sheer determination to say, I don't want to play there anymore. So if I'm great here, no one can make me play there. And it worked for Liverpool in the end.
Yeah, I must admit, Fabinho sounds like he's out this weekend, doesn't he? Which is a bonus from our side. I think he's one of the, if not the best defensive midfielder in the Premier League.
Yeah, it does sound like he's out. The manager's just done his press conference, and Fabinho, it sounds like it's more complicated, hopefully not too complicated, but it does sound like Fabinho is out. I always wonder on this if Liverpool might have just took a bit of a view and thought, we'll just keep him injured until the international break so he doesn't go away with Brazil. So it's three games now. It's Brighton, the Champions League game against Atletico, and then West Ham away. Now, I think we probably like him for Brighton and West Ham, and we take a gamble on Atletico, but I do wonder if Liverpool might just think, you know what, if we act like he's got no legs, the Brazilians can't pick him. And then we can keep him over here and all the COVID stuff from last time's not a problem.
Yeah, because that was a major issue of last play. Do you think you'll play pretty much your strongest team and not like not swap it around with Atletico coming up and stuff? Or
yeah, I think he'll go what he views as his first 11 broadly. There's a couple of areas where I think whoever partners Van Dijk is a horses for courses pick. I think he's gone with Matip at the early part of the season, but I think Matip's been the fittest one. He's not wanted to blood Konate immediately, but he's just played Konate at Old Trafford, so I don't think it's quite a pecking order there. I think it's who he fancies. Also, it takes Gomez time to get up to speed, and arguably he had the worst injury of everyone. I think he'll go first choice back four because it's just been a League Cup game. And then I think he'll have a little look at... I think it'll be Henderson. Keita is back fit after the terrible tackle from Pogba. And Jones, I think it'll probably be in the middle of the park. Oxlade-Chamberlain or Jones might be a bit of a decision he makes, but I think he'll go with Jones. And then it'll be in attack. It'll be three of Firmino. Well, it'll be Salah plus two of Firmino, Jota.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't see Manny. Much chance of Salah being rested.
I can't see it either. So it'll be Salah and then two of the other three. So, and again, that'll be, you know, Mane doesn't start at Old Trafford, but you would have thought Mane was in his first 11. So, I can't say which it'll be, but it'll be, you know, it'll be 11 of Liverpool's first 14 who are available, if you sort of see what I mean. And in the middle of the park, he'll go as strong as he can, I think, against Brighton.
I'm still holding out for a 24-hour bug for Salah. Nothing harmful. just say around Saturday morning time, you know, around then.
Maybe 48-hour one starting now will be good.
Just so we can relax a bit earlier.
Obviously, you've had some strikers who've been in amazing form over the years, but have you ever had anyone the form that Salah's in currently? And what do you make of the whole contract thing as well?
I think the Salah thing is, for the first time possibly since Kenny Dalglish, and even then it was a matter of a degree of debate, and it still is for Salah, to be fair. But you've got to go all the way back to that, really. You know, I think Gerrard's a little bit unfortunate not to win a Ballon d'Or. I think there's a period where Michael Owen, around sort of 2000, 2001, verges on downright unplayable. But this is perhaps the nearest thing Liverpool have ever had in amongst all the titles won, all the European trophies won. You know, I think there's a period where, for instance, Graeme Souness is utterly incredible, but where Liverpool might just have the best player in the world. And, you know, John Barnes can throw his hat into that ring, but Liverpool weren't able to be in European competition at that time, so it's difficult to tell. But it really is, you know, there's certain moments. And as I say, maybe Gerrard around 2007. Torres was unreal for a year and a half as a centre forward, but I don't think anyone really was arguing Torres was the best footballer in the world. Whereas right now, there's a chance that for this season, no matter when the big prize, the player of the year prize falls, for this season, 2021-2022, it's looking possible that Mo Salah might be the best footballer on the planet all the way through. And that's the first time that's happened, you know, in a modern sort of Liverpool parlance. As I say, I think you probably got to go back to Barnes, Souness, or Dalglish, all of whom plied the trade late 70s and through the 80s for that to be the case. And it is interesting. It is different. It is what we've seen since Salah broke through. He gets 44 goals in his first season. It's his fifth season. He scored unbelievable goals in every year, numbers of goals and unbelievable goals every year he's been here. But after he gets 44, he gets more enemy action. He gets more sides setting up to try to stop him. I think that sort of begins to ebb because Mane has an excellent 2019. But what you've got now is a situation where the side's setting up to have a Mo Salah plan, but Mo Salah's now too good for the Mo Salah plan. Like, you can have your plan to mitigate Salah, and it might be that Mane or Jota or Firmino can take advantage of the space that's left. But simultaneously, even whilst you're trying to mitigate for Mo Salah, he can still do you in. And I think that that's something, like, at a really high level. And I think that that's something which, you know, when he's done in, you know, the last three games, last four games, you know, he's done in Manchester City, champions of England, great team, goal and an assist. He's brilliant against Watford, goal and an assist, Watford relegation candidates. He's done in Atletico Madrid, champions of Spain, And then he goes and gets a hat-trick at Old Trafford. You know, these are all the different types of challenge. And we can talk United down any way you want, but there's been games where we've gone to Old Trafford while Salah's been at Liverpool and they've managed to deal with him. I think at the minute, he's all like, if I was advising an opposition manager, I'd be almost at the point of saying you might be worth not having a special Mo Salah plan. You just might need a Liverpool plan. And then hope to sort of stop the supply a little bit more and accept that he will hurt you at some point during the game and hope your goalkeeper makes a great save or you get a bit of luck or something like that. Because I think, you know, when you're looking at what he's doing, when he's surrounded by six defenders in the Watford case, five defenders in the Man City case, and the Man City players are amongst the best players in the world. If he's still doing that to them, then the idea that you can put some sort of special plan together that can stop him in the short term, you might be better off accepting it will happen, but just trying to stop him getting the ball to him a little bit more, stop the supply, stop Liverpool in general, stop Sadio Mane from capitalising on Salah's range of passing, stop all the other bits and sort of hope for the best with that bit. But then it's easy to say that when footballers need a plan and they need preparation.
Sorted. That's us sorted now, Peter, isn't it? We've got it. I mean, the particular brand of football that Salah's playing, you talk about the GOAT debate that constantly goes on and the best player at the moment, if that's different. And certainly Messi and Ronaldo have been all the talking points through the years. And there is something very messiistic about Salah's brand of football, isn't there? In terms of the jinking, the shuffling, the beating multiple players, the 1-2 elements, the link-up play, the assists. He's got all of that. There is a physical similarity as well, to a degree, isn't there?
Well, that's because he's coming off the right and he's shortish in stature. But for me, first and foremost, I think Messi's the greatest player ever to play the game. And agreed. I would be sort of genuinely surprised if, you know, when the three of us on this call all pop our clogs, if we don't all feel as though it's pretty close to still being the case. Like I feel as though there's a level Messi hits for eight seasons or so, which I just feel in his all round football play, not just the idea of goals or stuff like that, his all round play, that I just feel just literally may never be matched. And for me, I don't like the sort of the greatest of all time debate for a number of reasons. It's difficult to compare eras.
Yeah.
But for me, what Salah's currently doing in the Premier League, if you invert it, if you take the symmetry of it, it reminds me of Thierry Henry, where you've got this idea that there was a period of time where in the Premier League, Henry was the best number nine, best number 10 and best wide player in the country. And he was fulfilling all of those three functions at once. And that's sort of where Salah is at the moment. I think he's able to pull wide and really create space and hurt teams from out there. He's got this wonderful range of passing from all over the pitch, certainly from deep, again, wider areas where he's on that right-hand side but curls the ball around with his left foot. And then you've got the idea that in any situation, he could just pop up with a goal, that you can have this notion of, well, you know what he's trying to do, so why can't you just stop it? And in that period around sort of from 2000 to 2005, the number of times Thierry Henry would go onto the pitch and everyone knew everyone could draw the quintessential Thierry Henry goal, but he just kept scoring it. He just kept scoring it. And you'd be a bit like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Surely footballers know what he wants to do. And you're like, that still doesn't mean you can stop them. And if every now and again, when it was Henry on the left, you know, every now and again, if you do go with your left foot and still score, with like Salah scores against Manchester City with his right foot, if every now and again you do score it with your weaker foot, you know, the Craig Cathcart against Watford slides across Salah because he remembers the goal from last week when he just pinged it with his right foot. And then Salah makes him look like a dope. But Cathcart's thinking last week he scored past Edison with his right foot. So he could just score now. And that's
sort of escalating the fear factor, isn't it? It's escalating the fear factor. And then you've got more and more and more things to worry about within just the scope of one player. And it is taking it to a different stratosphere, isn't it? You said about Henry playing three different roles equally sensationally, and Salah's on that plane at the moment. I think you're right. That's the best comparison, I think, actually. And that is just different level. I think it may have been you guys. Somebody this week described them as out of this world class.
It was Graham Potter. No, but it's a great quote, and it shows you know the respect and you know Potter will have ideas around this, but I think what I like about Potter as a manager, and he reminds me a couple of ways of Klopp around this as well. You know, Klopp's just in his press conference and he was at pains to remind everyone that footballers are humans, as he often is, that, you know, people make mistakes and mistakes are made. You know, Potter and Klopp both know at all levels of football, you can have any plan you want in the world. Firstly, it still needs to be executed. But secondly, sometimes you can just come up against someone who on that day is able to just undo that plan. And I think that's what that's what Salah has been doing. You know, I don't think it's, I don't think, for instance, Manchester City aren't amongst the best coached and drilled footballers on the planet. And yet there is, you're left dealing with the brilliance of this and trying to find ways to mitigate it at most. And, you know, I think that when Potter uses that quote, it's a great quote. It's not world-class, it's out of this world-class. And he's absolutely spot on. You know, there's lots of great players, but at the moment, you know, Mo Salah looks amongst the greatest of them. And I don't sympathise with defenders coming up against him. He gave Danny Rose a torrid time, a real torrid time. Really felt sorry for Danny Rose, but whilst obviously also simultaneously finding it funny when he's playing for Watford against him. But we've all been there at any level of football we've ever been at. The really strange thing is the idea that you've got the Spanish champions and the English champions, and they're having that experience that we've all had at five-a-side where one lad's just too good. You're a bit like, that sort of shouldn't happen. You know, at the very elite of the game, this one lad's just too good. We can't live with him. And when you get to see it, and when you remember that, you know, the thing to always remember about all professional footballers is they're all better than the best player at your school. And then when you sort of multiply that by 100, you know, that, and then there's one player who looks that much better than everyone else. It almost shouldn't be. But at the minute with Salah, it has been. And if it continues, then he can power Liverpool to a league and European Cup double. That's not to say that will happen. You know, there's two great sides in this league along with us, I think. And there's also three or four other really good sides in Europe, Bayern Munich, Paris Saint-Germain, and Atletico Madrid, all look capable of stopping Liverpool, along with City and Chelsea. You know, Liverpool are not guaranteed a thing. But if you have the player who makes the best players for Manchester City and Atletico Madrid go, oh God, what do we do with this guy? Then it can only help.
Do you think that maybe the one, not necessarily weakness, but given obviously you're so good going forward, the one possible question mark is a little bit at the back at times with what happened against Brentford, obviously, and City obviously did score twice, although, I mean, it is City, so it's pretty good keeping
the defense too. No, I think Liverpool have skewed a tiny bit more towards attack so far this season. I think there's been a deliberate decision made. I think there's also the way the games have gone. I think crowds being back has suited Liverpool, not just from the idea of, oh, it's Anfield and it's noisy. In fact, not even that. More that the emotional responses of other players, opposition players. You take 11 individuals and we can think of them as a team, but everyone will have a slightly different emotional reaction to the way in which a football match is happening. And I think that there'll be a lot of players, and I think this will wear off soon, but they've just effectively had a year and a half of playing in empty stadia. Mm. And I think what Liverpool have been a bit more attacking, they've been a little bit more aggressive in the press than they were in 1920 when they last won the title. And I think that we've sort of played on that a tiny little bit. And at some point, sides will sort of stay together a little bit more over the course of 90 minutes. But I think so far, Liverpool are looking to be a bit more front foot. And of course, you know, to use Rafa Benitez's brilliant metaphor, football is a blanket that cannot cover your head and your toes at once. So you'll always end up with a little bit of a gap somewhere, however good you are. And I think Liverpool have compromised a tiny little bit on that solidity through the spine of the side. I think that they're at times overly front foot. I think there's a high line and there's a really high line, and Liverpool have sort of maybe been found wanting a little bit. I also think Liverpool haven't been great at 2-0 in a number of games. Obviously Watford and United recently are two good examples, and I think they're actually good at 2-0 against Man United. They invite a bit of pressure on, they withstand it. United aren't that bad at 2-0, but I think that if you look back through a run of games, we're not great against Brentford at 3-2 really, if we're honest about it. There's a couple of other little moments where I think Liverpool have almost got a bit carried away a tiny little bit. Atletico Madrid, it goes from 2-0 to 2-2 really quickly. Milan, Liverpool go from 1-0 to 2-1 before the break really quickly. So I think that there's little bits around Liverpool's game management that hasn't been quite right, that's been a bit emotional. I don't think Liverpool have been great, which they were in 1920, the 35 to 45, but before half-time, that 10-minute spell. I think there's been a couple of times where Liverpool have, I think because they've been a bit more at it in the first 30 minutes or so, the energy levels have begun to dip a tiny little bit, and I think that's something they'll be looking to improve on, maybe managing themselves a little bit better over the course of a half. But all this is splitting hairs at the moment. I mean, they've won 3 out of 3 in the Champions League group, including 2 away games, one of them against Atletico Madrid. They're unbeaten so far this season. They've played Chelsea, City and United at this stage. The Chelsea and City games are at home, and maybe, just maybe, at the end of the season, we might look back on one of them as 2 points dropped. There is the Brentford thing in there, but allow the idea that Brentford got up for it at 4:30 and, you know, it was a bit of a new threat. No one's got the data yet on what Brentford are good at. It's been a pretty good start to the season, but if you're asking me, do I think Brighton can score at Anfield? I absolutely think they can. And can they create a couple of good chances at Anfield? I absolutely think they can. It's down to Liverpool to stop them, and obviously it's down to Liverpool to ensure, with Mo Salah, but also with Firmino, Jota and Mane, that they do score more and create more.
Yeah, well, you've I listened to the preview segment on your latest free-to-air episode on the Anfield Wrap, and you were complimentary about us, saying, you know, it's not to be taken too lightly. We can get at you potentially. I think you predicted a 2-0 win on there, didn't you? For Liverpool.
Yeah, struggle.
Because you've said it's been close, hasn't it? A 1-0, a 2-1, and then of course the win for us last season.
Yeah, I'm expecting it to be a hard game. I'm not at all sort of complacent about it. I think it's going to be a struggle. I think the league's in a really funny place. In that, I certainly think you can, the sides, if you take United out of it because they're weird, the sides other than United who sit from 4th to 12th, maybe even 13th, maybe even include Crystal Palace in this, which I know you won't like, but I think Palace so far this season look like a proper footballing team for the first time in a while. Mm. I think you can take those sides and you can put them all in a big bag, and you could say, and you can use this phrase as a pejorative, which we tend to do in our lives, that they're all much of a muchness. But what I think about that is actually, this is a number of sides. Like Brighton's budget in a world football sense is top 30 at the moment. It's a top 30 budget in terms of what Brighton are able to spend on players in terms of wages and fees. And if Brighton, which they do, keep getting decisions right, that means that, you know, there's not the, I think at the minute, the gap between Brighton and West Ham, between Brighton and Arsenal, between Brighton and Tottenham, is as small as it's ever been. And in a couple of those instances, Brighton might actually be the better side. My point about this is to say, if Liverpool were playing Tottenham this weekend at Anfield, there'd be loads of people saying, could be tight, this could be a hard game. The fact is, if you're playing Brighton or Tottenham, the much of the muchness, these two sides, and that isn't a bad thing. It's to praise Brighton, to say that I am as concerned about Brighton coming to Anfield as I would be about Arsenal, Tottenham, West Ham at the moment. And it might be by the end of the season that's not quite the case, but right now I think this Brighton side, they look as capable of turning up for 90 minutes, frustrating and capitalising on Liverpool's frustration as any other side might be. And at the minute, you know, if you said to me you've come back from the future and Brighton finished sixth this season, I wouldn't go, well, this fella's obviously a madman. There's every chance Brighton finish sixth this season, because there's every chance Brighton can get a pathway to 60 points and other sides can't.
Yeah, well, I hope you're right. That would be nice. Sixth, we'd take that. A European tour.
Yeah,
exactly.
Nice. Oh, all sorts of obscure places to go to in Europa League next season. Yeah.
I mean, our head-to-head is actually fairly reasonable against you, all things considered. We've had 5 wins and 9 draws, which is a bit more than I thought, actually. And we have lost the 19, of course. I do think, I actually agree with you. I think it'll be a 2-0 to Liverpool this weekend. That's my prediction. We'll get Peter's in a moment. But in terms of thrashings, you've got a couple of them out of your system recently. We're taking that as a positive sign. Yeah, the Watford game, and obviously the Man U, which you must have hated every minute of, I'm sure, Neil. Terrible, especially the 65th minute. I don't know if you, because I think you had to catch it on TV, didn't you? But it was that scene where they showed the outside of the ground and loads of people flooding away on 65. Was absolutely magnificent.
Oh, it was. I mean, the whole thing was a televisual masterstroke. The cutting from Ferguson to Dalglish was glorious.
Oh, yes. Someone's having fun in the editing, weren't they?
Oh, the sheer melodrama of, and I'd very rarely say this, not least because, you know, for ancient rivalries, and also recently, I think, you know, we've talked again about football finance and stuff like that. There's been times where he's wound me up a little bit across the last 12 months or so. But honestly, we were going from pub to pub after the match, and there was a point where we were just walking into another boozer and Gary Neville's still on the telly having to explain what's just happened to Manchester United. I began to feel really sorry for him. Will someone get Gary off the telly? Will someone just let him go and have a drink and go home? Because good Lord, you just made him do all the build-up where they were winding him up like nobody's business before kickoff, before the kickoff of the West Ham game, they'd started winding him up, and then in the, you know, and then he has to do the prior thing to the match. Then Liverpool go 1-0 up in 5 minutes, and he stood next to Carragher, and he has to then do the commentary on the whole game, where he's beginning to adopt the tone of one of the Attenboroughs during a state funeral towards the end of it, as this game wears on. And then from there, they then put him into the studio, and they make him do about another hour and a half, 2.5 hours of Gary Neville somberly to camera with Souness and Carragher absolutely laughing their heads off at him. Oh, it got to the point where I was like, it was like reality TV. Can someone please just get Gary off the screen? Sub him in for another United pundit. That's all right, but just someone save Gary from this, please.
pure cruelty. And you were saying off air as well, our friend of the show as well, John Gibbons, your colleague, was actually at both that and the Everton game at the weekend.
Yeah, he was had to.
Somehow we've matched.
He was at through a raffle that he won. He was at Goodison and Old Trafford in the weekend, where Everton are 2-1 up with 12 minutes to go and finish 5-2.
And also conceded a hat trick to a player they briefly had and must have barely scored. They didn't score three goals even for them, did they?
He didn't score one, I don't think, or he got only one. The Josh King thing that I loved was Josh King did for the first, when he scored his first goal against them, he did muted celebrations. By the time he got to goal three, he had his top off. It was like the journey he went on. I mean, it doesn't genuinely, weekends do not get better than that from a Liverpool point of view. So John enjoyed it the most. But in general, listen, you know, it doesn't always work like that, football. And I think on this game coming on Saturday, the one thing that I'm sort of trying to nail in all of our sort of content speaking to Liverpool supporters is I think Saturday's just going to be hard. And I think it's not going to be a lot of laughs. And I think Brighton are going to be really well set up. And I think there's going to be three or four Brighton players where Liverpool are going to have to accept there's a period of time where they win their battle. And I think there'll be a period of time in my 2-0. I think Liverpool will have to suffer a little bit at some point at 0-0 and 1-0. Before sort of securing it. I feel as though, you know, it's going to be not chastening as such, hopefully not chastening for Liverpool, but I think it's going to be a really hard Saturday afternoon. And then from there, I think it'll be one of those where you'll almost be glad. I'm glad we've got them out the way for a while, because, you know, it's not, whilst it's nice to have a home game before having Atletico at home in the Champions League, I actually even think that having Brighton at home, there's kind of homes before you've got to deal with Atletico in this division at the minute. I think it's going to be a really tough one.
I have to say, I don't have quite your faith in our defence. Last week, we decided to pretty much defend on the halfway line against Man City.
But you're not going to do that again. You're not going to do that again.
Really hope we don't try it again, because we're out of sight at half-time. It was basically Dunk against Foden on the halfway line quite a bit of the time. And it's like, yeah, we need to actually defend a little bit deeper. I'm not advocating sitting on our six-yard box, but... Yeah. When you need that much space behind the players with that much pace, then
sometimes this happens where in this role, listen, I don't think you play teams like Liverpool. I think one of the things that works with teams like Liverpool and City is that no one plays teams like Liverpool and City apart from four times a season. Brighton will come on for that against City. They'll learn from it. You know, the videos are there. You want to explain stuff to your defenders. You want to do things a little bit differently. No one wants to get beat 4-1 at home. So it's the easiest bit of coaching ever. How does that not happen to us again? Please,
don't
Gaffer.
Do that again.
Yeah. So don't do this. Let's do this instead. I think, you know, again, I'd rather, if Liverpool and City are playing a team back-to-back, I'd much rather we played them first.
I think we're playing back-to-back later in the season as well, but I can't remember which order it's in. Might be the same order.
Annoying that.
I can't remember. It might be the other way around. I don't know, but it's definitely, I remember the fact we're playing you both two in a row.
Yeah.
Both times.
But of course, We won both games last season. We beat City 3-2 from 2-0 down. I think maybe that's why we went 2-0 down on Saturday. We thought we'd just try and emulate what happened last time. Didn't work too well.
Yeah, but then, it lasted 2 minutes, didn't it? So yeah. We then went 3 down immediately.
3 down, yeah. So I don't think we were ever going to emulate that result. Unfortunately, we didn't. I think the same again with the Liverpool game. I'm going with you on a 2-0. Unfortunately, I can't go up for the weekend. Peter, you are going up. What's your prediction ahead of your travel? Are you going to make it a full house of 2-0s?
I think it's going to be... I think we might score, actually. I think it might be 3-1 or even the 4-1 that happened last weekend again. Mainly because... Yeah. And it could go either way. It could be that we play like we did again on Saturday for the first half and it's out of sight. And then we kind of... maybe improve second half and Liverpool take their foot off the gas with Atletico coming up and West Ham, you're saying, next weekend. Or it could be that we actually have a bit more of a game and, you know, it's 2-0 and then 2-1 until quite late on and you guys get the late goals, you know, make it safe or whatever. But either way, I think it'll end up 3-1. It'll just be obviously a lot more enjoyable to watch if we keep it interesting for most of the game rather than being 3 down at half-time like Saturday.
Just before we let you go, Neil, I've got to ask you on one hot subject that's been going on at the moment. There was a banner at the Palace game against Newcastle. I'm wondering if when you guys play them, there'll be something similar. And we've got them soon, actually. What's your take, very briefly, on if you can do it briefly, on the Saudi-Newcastle situation?
I think I found it deeply sad, and I still find it deeply sad. I understand, let's all be honest about this, I've defended some wrong things in the name of defending Liverpool Football Club, but I think this should be a difficult one to rationally defend. And when you find yourself doing a lot of mental gymnastics, that's the point as a football supporter where you maybe need to breathe in and out for a minute or two. So I found it really, I found that aspect of it really rather sad. And I think that that's the main part which makes it difficult. To be absolutely brutally clear, Ashley should never have been allowed to buy that football club and run it the way he did. If football was better governed, then you'd have to be clear on what your plan is for a football club and have to stick to it. So you can buy a football club, but you'd almost do it under license to a degree, is something that I wouldn't mind seeing be in place. And there's a little bit of a model in a couple of countries, Germany being one of them, around that, where you have to almost
custodians.
You have to publish your business plan to an extent. So where I understood the idea of celebration was that they got rid of Ashley, because the one thing that Ashley did brilliantly was drain Newcastle of all hope. And obviously what the idea of being bankrolled by Saudi Arabia offers is the idea, well, we can at some point, and I think it'll take longer and be harder than Newcastle supporters currently think, but at some point we can end up with the best players in the world and we can win trophies. And I understand that. I understand the idea of hope. But ultimately, this little game of ours, which we all love, and, you know, Peter is travelling all the way up across the country. Hopefully he's going to have a lovely time in Liverpool, like we get to have a lovely time in Brighton. It's about lovely times, and it's not about, you know, it's not about geopolitics, and it's not about all the other bits and pieces. It should be, first and foremost. I understand there's a lot of money in the game now, and I understand the extent to which it and lots of other things are massive businesses, and have become massive businesses that at one time were almost like social entertainments. You know, there's lots of examples of this. Formula One is nothing but really expensive go-karting, as an example. You know, you can see this across a great many sports and a great many entertainments, but this is sad, and I think it shows a lot of shortcomings in a lot of processes, not just in the short term, but also in the longer term, as I said before about Ashley. So, you know, football in general has got to have a little think about it, but what is a shame is to see a really partisan, aggressive, proud City end up having to perform, as I said before, mental gymnastics to defend what should be indefensible. And the Adam Crafton piece in The Athletic around LGBTQ people in Saudi Arabia was really, really strong and really effective. Actually, I found it quite upsetting. And so I think we've just got to, where possible, try to divorce Newcastle supporters from it and try to help Newcastle supporters divorce themselves. And I think pointing the finger and acting firstly as though all the football supporters are whiter than white doesn't help. I think banners like the Crystal Palace one are a good thing because they keep certain things in the public eye. But the flip side of that is what we can't all do is act as though we've got to treat literally match-going Newcastle supporters as pariahs. What we've got to try and do at every opportunity is hold out an olive branch and say, you know, we've got to try and find a way for you to come over here rather than act as though, no, you're now just still stuck with them forever. Because what all that'll do is harden attitudes, and it'll actually make the part of what underpins what the Saudi Arabians are trying to do by buying Newcastle, it'll actually make that easier for them. So let's not make it easier for them. Let's make it so that we can see ourselves as a football community as much as possible and say that we don't want this sort of thing. And these are the reasons why, and this is what has to change.
Yeah, there's a lot of robust defences already going on from Newcastle fans, which you suspect is partly due to this us and them kind of mentality that started to manifest itself.
Yeah. I mean, it underpins all the football. All the football is, I mean, I was just laughing at Everton a few minutes ago. You know, all the football is an us versus them, you know, to an extent. You know, on Saturday, it's us versus them. It's Liverpool versus Brighton. And for me, I'm the us, you're the them. But there's ways where we can remember that. I'll say it again, you know, it is, there's a line on one of our shows that, you know, it is a leisure activity. It is just a game. It's a leisure activity we want to enjoy as much as possible. It's a leisure activity that says something about where and who we are in an identity sense. It's got all these things that do underpin it, and it is important, but it is not as important as very basic human rights. Yeah. And I think that is a thing to always cling to.
Because I think that Adam Crafton article, if I'm not mistaken, is the one where he was speaking to people who are from oppressed backgrounds in Saudi or who were in Saudi. And he was trying to explain what the delight was that the Newcastle fans had got rid of Mike Ashley, what that was all about. And when he was saying it out loud to them, he found himself cringing. He said, well, he's put Wonga on the shirts and he's slapped his company name all over the place and didn't invest that much. It all sounds pretty hollow when, you know, the people being upset by them being allowed to sports wash, been committing atrocities.
No one's suggesting Mike Ashley was a great owner, but I do think some of the delight from Newcastle fans when the Saudis took over was over the top, considering who was taking over then. You know,
I think it's a mix, isn't it? Though as well, I think in that same article or in his interview on the podcast, he said that there's a lot of people sort of tutting at those that are doing that, walking up to the ground and stuff like that. We have to put it in perspective. So I do think there's a number of Newcastle fans
who are cringing watching Newcastle as a result. Or they won't watch them until
exactly. Possibly.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, Neil, we better let you go. Otherwise, you're not going to have any for the rest of the day left. So it's always a pleasure to have you.
Really, always a pleasure as well.
Yeah. Excellent. And maybe when you're down, I can't make it to Liverpool, but when you're down in Brighton, maybe go out for a beer.
Absolutely. March.
Yes, indeed. We look forward to it. And in the meantime, Peter, that wraps it up for this episode anyway. So we'll sign out in the usual way. Stand or fall.
Up the Albion.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.